everybody. On this episode of AfterBuzz TV Spotlight On, we're getting up close and personal with the writer, director, producer, and star of The Wedding Invitation, Randy Kerwin. Let's do it.
You're tuning into the destination for TV superfan discussion, AfterBuzz TV. And now, let the buzz begin.
Oh, look at that. Leftover Cuties playing us into this episode of AfterBuzz TV Spotlight On. This is the show where we get up close and personal with all the people that are responsible, either in front of or behind the camera, to bringing you all that great entertainment that you get to watch on the big screen, at home on your TV, or maybe on one of your mobile streaming devices. I'm your host, Frank Moran. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at HappyGoJackie. Now, during my brief open before the show started there, I listed basically all these descriptions of Randy Kerwin here. She, writer, director, producer, and star. She took total control of the film that she wanted to make. We're going to find all about that, all about her life, everything in the next hour. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Randy Kerwin. Oh my goodness.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Oh, but the pleasure is all mine. So we played the Leftover Cuties there. Yeah, Smile Big.
I do every time I hear it. Something about that song. Somebody told me about that song. And I think of all, because we have 23, or not original songs, but local artists mostly in the film. And I didn't have the opening song. I thought I did, and then we couldn't get it. And so I just reached out to them cold and said, this is a little trailer. This is the film. Is there any way you would consider, you know, letting us use your song? And they wrote back and said, yeah, do it.
That's great.
Yeah.
Now, as not only just the writer and director, but producer, when it comes to finding the music for a film, how hard is that? Are you as you're writing some scenes, do you have some songs already popping in your head? Do you kind of do that more once you get into post?
You know, this is really interesting because I'm a first-time filmmaker, and when you do that, you can't know everything, and you shouldn't, or you wouldn't start. That's my theory. But, you know, because you just wear so many hats, and it was not something that I thought about. But a couple weeks ago, I was on a panel at the Society of Composers and Lyricists, and I was asked about the score in it and music in it, and did I think about that, and did that, you know, influence the writing in any way for scenes? And, you know, it really didn't. I have other projects that it has, but this one I was always going for this fun, big, you know, studio kind of romp on a micro budget, right? So I didn't think about it so much as I had a feel for what I wanted, but nothing really specific. So I had to put all that together afterwards, which was challenging to say the least. I mean, even to get a little bit farther in it, I'd heard score. Listen, I love movies. I'm obsessed with movies. I've felt score more than I've ever heard it. But so when I went to score the film, I was floored. I was floored because I had to temp score it, meaning I had to go listen to score from hundreds of movies and take those pieces and put them in a temporary way so that my composer would know what I wanted. So yeah, this was a huge challenge for me, who's very musically challenged. I just like what I'm listening to.
Now, yeah. I understand when you do like the spotting session with your composer, yeah, where you're kind of going through that, and you already got I've had her described as like basically the composer kind of sits the director on the couch, and it's almost like like a psychiatrist kind of just trying to draw out what even they're not really kind of expressing maybe in thoughts, but to find out what they need for this film.
Right. And this was interesting because a lot of this I had not thought of until we sat down. But I knew the feel that I wanted, but I didn't know that that's a string and that's a clarinet. And, you know, I didn't know that sort of. That was not my language. That's why I really temp scored everything. But, yeah, a spotting session, you sit down and you say, there shall be score from this frame, this minute to this frame, to this minute to this frame. And then we're going to pull it out. And then we're going to have a song here. Then we're going to have nothing here. And I have a very musical film. I have a lot of music in it. I just wanted to give it that kind of fun feel. And to me, music and score does that. But we sat down. I mean, and it's not fancy. It wasn't a couch. It was a rolling chair like this. And we sat in his loft, which was lovely. And, you know, it's just a giant Excel spreadsheet that he labels everything. So we would have themes that would repeat, you know, moment of despair, hopeful, but not. Like, he had all these, like, really fun. His name is Duncan Thumb and David Bertok are the two composers. And so we would sit there and come up with these really kind of fun little ways and color code, like green. The green theme would come back. So that score could repeat to some degree throughout the film, and it would kind of give it that cohesive thread as we watch this film. And it it built it, you know, it really built the film.
So as somebody that you've kind of described, similar to Lucy in some respects, the character that you play in The Wedding Invitation is the idea of the highlighters, post-it notes, organization.
Yeah.
So when the composer says, you know what, I'm going to pull up the sweet Excel sheet, we're going to start putting everything, are you like, now you are speaking my language?
Yes. Yes, because I love Excel spreadsheets. But at the same time, I mean, he just saw me go white when we finished putting, like, because they're like music cues, you know, and there was so many of them. And he's like, it's okay, calm down. And then he showed me, he like held my hand and he showed me what it should look like at the end when it's all filled in. I'm like, okay. But they even said that David and Duncan even said, like, this was a very heavily scored film. I think we had about 25 pieces of score in it. So that's a lot for a film.
So what's it like when you have that spotting session and then you're done and then they come back to you and say, all right, here's what we think. And you finally get to see their music married with your pictures.
Yeah. It was so good. It was so good because, you know, as you know, score is meant, taking score from a different movie and putting it in yours, it's not ideal, but it actually sometimes can work because it's like, you know, there's moments that it can hit. And mine was comedy. So we could, you know, move it around to have it hit. But then when somebody writes specific score for your film, I mean, that's amazing because I felt like all of the comedy was punctuated, you know, and often what I would do, because I don't have notes on, like, oh, this works or this feels maybe a little too fast or too slow. I mean, that's my lame language when talking about music. But what I would sometimes do is my little trick is I like to pull music out for a funny moment. Like there's a totally inappropriate scene in bed. We call it the mustache scene.
Yes.
there's that moment where he says that line and I pull the music out right before that. And I feel like, you know, that's when the music is so great because the absence of it sometimes is equally as good as having the music in there.
Was it hard? Because we're using temp music. I can understand you can kind of get married, even though you know
it's
temporary. You get married to your temp
love. It's the term.
Was it easy to kind of like put that aside, and then once you get to hear the new music that is brought in for your film specifically, like, oh wow, this is even better than I thought.
Yeah, it was. There was a couple times when it wasn't because it's an 80s prom themed wedding and we had the girls dancing to a song that I danced to when I was a kid. I mean, maybe it was like late 80s, trying not to age myself, but let's be honest. but that was the song that was a song that I was always going to have in this film. That was going to be the song in the prom. And we couldn't get it. Like, we could not afford that song. But what we got was this really cool 80s band that made their own 80s music, but nowadays. So it was great to find things like that. But for the most part, I was blown away with the score because it just was tailored to my film.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, speaking of that, because you're editing the film based off the temp music, and then once the composers come back, are they composing it to how you've edited it to the temp music, or once they give you that music, you kind of tweak some of your scenes to kind of fit
that
music?
Once we picture locked, we didn't change anything. Okay. So, yeah, and there were very few moments. Like, if you're cutting a trailer, you can't do that. You have to change the edit to fit the music sometimes. Although, I have to say, Alexis Grapsis, who did the music edit on this, it's amazing what he can do with things to just the way he extends a beat. Or it's amazing that it actually works so well, even though we already have the edit down, that he can still manipulate the music so that it actually really hits. But yeah, for the most part, yeah, nothing was recut based on music. So they have a job to do, you know, it's tough.
So now to jump back, we got a little on the Wedding Invitation, but let's jump back just a little bit about you. Are you a native Angeleno?
I always stutter when I answer that question. Yes. Sounds like a lie is about to come out. No, I was born in Los Angeles. My father was a film editor. And my mom was from Canada, and they met hitchhiking through Europe. And yes, fell in love and came to LA and had my sister and I. And then when I was 3 and my sister was 5, we went to Winnipeg. At the time, against my will, because it was freezing, I since have fallen in love with Winnipeg. But so I grew up in Winnipeg. Winnipeg's my hood.
Yeah. So as somebody, your father, a film editor.
Yeah.
Was he
did commercials and stuff.
Okay.
Mostly, yeah. Like he wore the glove, like a cutter.
Oh, like wow. Old school, yes.
Putting it Exacto knife or something. Doing a little plug for Exacto.
So was basically just movies and media just in your blood right from the beginning?
You know what I think happened? Because there's not a lot. There is a lot of that now in Winnipeg, but not when I was growing up. But what happened when I was young, my cousin, Scott Curtis, was... I don't think he's ever heard this, but he lived in LA, and he was on every show you could be on in the 80s. Like, he was like 5 years old, and he was on Santa Barbara and Highway to Heaven, and he was friends with Leonardo DiCaprio, who played Stinky on one of those sitcoms from the 80s.
Was it Growing Pains?
Growing Pains, yeah. So he was on all of these shows, and so I would watch these shows at a very young age and I want to do what Scott's doing. So I think that's where the initial seed was planted. And then from there on out, I just talked my mom into signing me up for every kind of acting class I could in Winnipeg. And I started out doing local commercials at CKND TV in Winnipeg. That was my
little start. Nice. Yeah.
You know what's funny, actually? To bring it full circle, I'm doing a road trip to Winnipeg for the next 6 weeks. And when I get there, I'm doing three TV interviews. And one is at the old CKND.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so just a few years later, I came back.
So when you're doing that, is it what you thought it was going to be just by watching your cousin on TV? It's like, oh, yeah, this is really cool. Or is it different than what you thought it was going
to
be?
I was incredibly unsuccessful for a very long time. I mean, I got on a bus when I was 18 after graduating. We call it grad back home, not prom, but, you know, basically my prom. And 4 days later, I was in LA. And, you know, I think of the business as a triangle. And it's not that you can't move around. Certainly you can. But I really plugged in at the bottom. You know, like, and so we're sort of at the bottom as I came as an actor. You're scrounging for that one-line audition. Like, you know, it's not even like you're scrounging for a role. You're just excited to get one-line audition. And so I attacked it like a business, kind of very desperately. And I didn't have any, I mean, I did a couple independent films and stuff and some little TV, but I didn't have any success. And then my breaking point is I had an audition for That 70s Show for one line. The line was thank you, and I didn't get a call back. And I had worked so hard to get that audition. I was doing showcases. I'd become friends with the casting director, who was G. Charles Wright at the time. And I went in for that audition. I'm like, how bad was I, right? I couldn't have, well... Who knows? Maybe I was terrible, but I didn't get a call back, and that was my falling down point, and I just realized something's wrong. I've been here a couple years, and I'm struggling so much, and I don't, like, it was so hard to, I must have worked 6 months to get that audition, you know? So I looked at those people that were successful, that had created their own vehicles, like Nia Vardalos with My Big Fat Greek Wedding, who's also from Winnipeg, or Rocky, or Swingers, or all these people, and I was like, you know, I think they're all great, and maybe they would very much have careers today if they hadn't created their own, but that ignited them. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, oh, naively, well, I'll do that. I'll just do that. So I started to write knowing nothing. And At the time, I just had Word. I didn't even have Final Draft, like, which is the editing software. Yeah. And I just tab, 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 character name, tab, tab, tab. Line of action, you know, and so I just started writing, and that's how this all kind of came to be, out of frustration and necessity.
So when you are growing up and you want to pursue this as mm-hmm. a career, with your dad, kind of at least be, you know, related to the industry, was he like, ooh, Rainey, this might not be the wisest choice?
Yeah. What's so funny, because it was just Father's Day, and he and I just had this conversation, because like, he always said, you know, okay, but you're gonna also be a lawyer, right? Right? You're gonna be a lawyer, and then you do this for fun on weekends. You'll do a play.
That's right, yeah. But try cases during the week, and then shoot some stuff on the weekend.
And then I can be dramatic in front of the court, like I love to be. But we had this conversation, and maybe I shouldn't say this because he's listening, but when I was not going to play Lucy this round. Like, this film was set up very differently to be a $10 million film, and it all fell apart like 7 years ago. But so this round, I wanted to get a name for the lead role of Lucy, and I was going to play Ryan, which Camille Guadi killed it. Nobody could touch that. The thought of me even playing it compared to her, no, she's amazing. But I was directing it, and I was going to play Ryan. And then it just... We couldn't get the name, first-time writer or director. You know, nobody was giving us their name actors. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, I wrote it for me. I know how Lucy's meant to be played. I think that will eliminate a step in translation when it comes to directing. And I, you know, worked for the last 8 years as an acting coach and director at an acting conservatory. And so I'm really comfortable working with actors. And I think I'm pretty good at knowing if I got it or not. Like, do I need another take? I'm like, I'm going to take Lucy. And my dad was like, Okay, but then you need to get somebody else to direct it. You can't do both. The rules tell you you cannot do both. And we were just laughing about that on Father's Day. I was like, I did it.
Yeah, broke all the rules. That, what do you think about that?
Yeah.
Now, is your sister, she involved in the entertainment business?
No, but she was. She used to be, she used to do wardrobe. So she was on Glitter and Chicago. But no, she said, not for me. And she lives a very spiritual life. So yeah, she went a complete opposite direction.
Is she up in Winnipeg still, or is she elsewhere?
She's elsewhere.
She's elsewhere, just elsewhere. When you're living a spiritual life, you are elsewhere.
She was in LA recently, but she's a traveler and a lover and a healer and just an amazing spirit. So she just, you know, wanders in a great way.
So when you finished grad, as I out there in Canada, Winnipeg, was there any point where you're thinking, maybe I'll go to New York first, or LA was always your go-to destination?
Well, I think I was, I don't know what the... Well, I do know what the draw is. I've loved LA from day one. And if I'm ever having a bad day, I just look up at a palm tree. Like, it's, that's always been, because I was in Winnipeg and I so fiercely felt like I needed to be in LA from a very young age. I was obsessed with LA. So I was always coming to LA, but we would come back here every 2 or 3 years. We'd drive down from Winnipeg.
But how long is that drive?
It's, I think it's 40 straight hours.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, maybe it's a little less. Maybe it's 30 straight hours. It's long, but I mean, this is what we did. You know, we grew up camping, no shoes, in our bathing suits all summer. You know, this was like, well, because it's, you know, 10 months of winter. So the minute you can put your bathing suit on, they have to pry it off me at the end of the season.
Absolutely. I mean, I feel like when you're used to growing up in a cold climate where it's like 50 degrees seems like the summer. So it's like bust out the shorts, the swimsuit, we're doing it. When everybody that's used to the warm climate, like, no, 50, what are you kidding? No,
right.
Give me my sweatshirt.
And I'm calculating as you say this because I think I'll always be a Celsius girl. No, I'm good if it's like 100. I know what 100 is. But when it gets to cooler, I'm like, 50, okay, so double it and add 20. Yes. And zero is zero, which is freezing, which is great.
That's right.
For me.
Really like that. Zero and 100, we're great. I can deal with all those. Yeah. So did you have stops along the way that it was like, anytime we go do this trip, we always stop, like, say, Portland, Seattle, or?
No, we never stopped. I mean, Winnipeg is central, so we'd always come down through Colorado.
Okay.
But we wouldn't stop. My dad was a maniac. He would just drive straight.
Oh.
I mean, we would pull over, and he would sleep for a couple hours, and he would just drive. But we've done it so many times. My mom and him would switch off, or I did it. I've done it a couple times since I've been here. I drove down the first time. I'm about to do it again.
You're going to drive?
I'm driving back to Winnipeg in July. Yeah.
Will you be doing stops, or are you going to try to channel your father and just like, I'm going straight through?
No, I'm not going to channel Carrie Kerwin. I'm going to stop a lot. This is my, after 3 years of like 7 days a week on this film, I'm going to do nothing or everything or I'm going with my dog. And my uncle Frank is coming with me until Colorado, so we'll
nice.
He'll help out and keep me awake. But we're just gonna do nothing. Like we don't know. We're just gonna stop if there's a place to swim. Like that's my goal.
Not a bad. That seems like it's always nice when you don't have like an objective, the ultimate objective. But along the way, you can just do what you feel like. If you want to stop somewhere, you can.
Yes, and I've never gone through life that way. I always have an objective. I mean, I think because I've been out here so long that it was always to get to the finish line. And this certainly isn't the finish line, but it's a finish line. Like, I feel like I've always, in a heartfelt moment, I think I've always personally had so much fear that I've always moved the goalpost. Like, I wanted to be an actor. Okay, that's really hard. I'll just make it harder because I'm about to win or fail at that. So then I'll write. Oh, okay, then I'll produce. Then I'll direct. And then at some point, like, the goalpost is at the end, and you have to then make the movie. You know, like, okay, I'm going to make the whole movie. You know, and so I feel like I'm at a finish line, I guess, along the way, where I can take 6 weeks off.
No, absolutely. Well, there are those people that I feel when they do a marathon, there are people that run it once and say, you know what, that was great. I never need to do it again. And there's others say, this, I love the challenge.
Yeah.
Sign me up for the next one.
Yeah, I'm not going to run a marathon.
No, not another. Oh, all right.
But I might make another movie. Yeah.
So when you moved down here, you mentioned your uncle that you're going to be starting this road trip off of. Well, was he living here in Los Angeles?
So I used to have some family here, and they have pretty much, with the exception of Uncle Frank, picked up and left. So they're all in Bend. So I have my Canadian family, which I hung out with, and we do the cottage and that fun part. And then I had my American family who don't know each other, you know, completely separate. But they've mostly left and gone to Bend. So I have godparents here, which I'm very close to. So I get to see them a lot. So I think it's, you know, LA is a hard city to start out in. It's not like New York where you're on the subway and you can make a friend or have contact or be with people. LA, you're in your car and it's very, I think people take a couple years to settle down. You come to LA with a dream and a mission and we're on a little bit. And I'm guilty of that too, of trying to be this person or persona of what I think I need to be. But I think after a couple years, you settle in and you find what I call my family. And my friends are my family, you know? So, and I think because nobody really has family here, you need that, mm-hmm. you know, you need to find those people. So I have Uncle Frank and Hawk and Molly, and I have my friend family who I couldn't have made this film without.
Hawk, that's an awesome name. That's so cool. Like, big fan of that name. So as you start you've been teaching in the conservatory mm-hmm. for 8 years.
Yeah.
What led you involvement in getting involved with that conservatory?
You know, a friend of mine, a good friend, my family, mm-hmm. Casey, was teaching there, and she's like, I think you would like this. I think you would just like to do this. And at the time, I was writing, and I didn't want to wait tables anymore. I'm like, okay, I'll try it. And I fell in love with it. Like, I could do that for the rest of my life, and my cup would be full. It has been the most amazing experience. Gary Spatz, who runs the conservatory, is just a beautiful spirit, and people just gravitate to him. But it's grown and grown. I mean, they have 6 studios, and it's called The Playground, and you know, all of my family and friends have come from that. But what it taught me was, because it's mostly teens was kind of my bag, but it's children to teens, and it gave me permission to get in there and figure out how to fix a scene. So even though I don't have a film school background and I'm not as much a technical director, with actors I feel really confident. And because I worked with over 1,000 actors in 8 years, it gives you that ability to go in and know how to talk to actors rather than give them line readings. And mm-hmm. I think that's really important because I'm a huge believer in intention and truth in any scene. I don't care if it's comedy or drama. That's where I come from. And I feel like you can tell in 1 second if somebody's saying a line or actually going after their intention. And that's the only thing I ever focus on as a director. It's not how you're saying it. It's what are you getting? Because I say mimic life, and in life we all want something. I want something from you right now, and you want something from me, right? And so how I'm saying things using my hands, you know, we're always after something. And I think when you put that into acting, it really, it makes it so much easier.
How did your acting change? Because certainly by coaching and helping with students, certainly that influences you too. So how does your acting change since you worked with these students at the conservatory?
Well, I think it gave me a confidence as an actor. And I think you become very judgmental, as you need to be in these moments to see what's working and to see what's not working. But it's amazing what you learn. Like, I've always heard of actors saying, oh, I would go in for sessions or casting, where they were casting, and I would run the camera, and I learned so much from that, just watching people walk in or seeing who was believable or not and why. I feel like it's the exact same thing spending 8 years in a studio watching kids and teens try to figure it out and watching them go through their process of it. I think it changed in a big way. I actually credit The Playground in a massive way that I don't think that I would have taken on directing this film had I not had that experience and that just kind of the fearlessness of doing it, having done it on a daily basis.
I'm curious when it comes to directing a film, because there are more like the actors, directors, more technical directors. Yeah. But I also feel like if you're hiring a great crew, the technical side, at least in my opinion, seems like it would take care of more
of
itself.
And that's what I did.
Yes. Then that way you can just really focus on dealing with the actors and getting the best performance from
them. Yeah. And my DP was amazing. We had, so this is the first feature I've shot. We shot a little trailer, a little sizzle trailer right before we shot this for the next, my next feature. And so we got to know each other on that. And we just hit it off. Like, we speak the same language on set. We high five and call each other dude. So much fun. Her name is Alicia Robbins, and she's an amazing DP. So she was so helpful, and she knew that, you know, so I never had to put on airs about having to pretend. I'd be like, no, I don't get this, explain this. Okay, got it, great, then let's not do that, or let's do that. So she had my back, and I had a producing partner too, Sage Scroop, who had my back too, and that she sat through all of my rehearsals so that when I was on camera, she was when I was in front of the camera, she was behind the camera. So what I would do is I would roll. Oftentimes I just cut myself, you know, I would roll till I felt like I had it. And then I would just watch playback. So I watched playback on absolutely everything, but it's a challenge. But the thing I did though, to kind of get over that challenge was I rehearsed the day players. I rehearsed everybody because it's comedy.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if you don't understand it, if you don't understand the beat and the moment and what you're going for, it's not going to work ever. So that all needed to be worked out. So Camille and Christina Ulloa, who plays Nectar, they spent many, many hours at my house working through these moments. So we would get to set. I mean, and we're an indie film, right? So we're doing somewhere between 5 and 10 pages a day, you know? And so we had a system where we would block, light, rehearse, shoot. And we would go in that order. And rehearsing was working in the blocking and what we rehearsed, you know, during the rehearsal and in prep. So we had to be on, and there wasn't time to work this stuff out. I mean, I would love to be shooting a page a day. Like, it's the dream.
That is, now, do you feel like the crew, do they want a director that can really speak their language, or they're fine with a director that knows what they want but is fine to ask questions and look for that expertise from those people that you've hired?
Yeah, well, I have to say the crew on this was amazing. It was an all-female crew. And everybody was so supportive. And, you know, energetically, that was so helpful to me. I don't know if they know that, but they were on board. So if I had an idea or I wanted some this or that, there was production design, which is Sean Graves, killed it. I would say, can we do this? And they would, you know, everybody was on my side always. Like, because we'd worked out, you know, the script had been vetted and we'd worked that out. So everybody was just there to kind of make the vision come alive. And because this was not a huge budget, nobody was there. I mean, everyone was being paid, but nobody was there just for the money. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody had to be there. They were taking pay cuts to be there. So it just felt like energetically that we were all moving in the same direction, and they were really supportive of it.
That's got to be nice to be able to have a crew that wants to be there.
Yeah.
Yeah, as opposed to like, yeah, all right, whatever. Yeah, no, sure, rainy. Okay, yeah. Fine, whatever.
Especially when you're going overtime. We did try to have good food. It was advice that you got to have good food.
Yes.
No pizza. No pizza. Yeah.
So now, as you're mentioning, that you originally had this several years ago. You'd written this film and tried to shop it around. And a lot of men that would read it, it's like, you know, not really interested in getting behind this film and supporting it. That I don't understand why that it seems so frustrating to me that men would just be kind of like, I don't understand
this.
It was
really frustrating because, you know, I was a first time everything, unsuccessful back then, but a lot of it came together so easily to some degree. We didn't get it over the finish line with funding, but you know, I gave it to this producer, this, and she loved it, and we went out to a director at Gersh, and she loved it. She was going to be in town and wanted to meet with us. And we had an AP on board and a sales agent, and everyone signed on, and we had an A-list casting director. And so it grew and grew and grew, but I didn't, not by design, but it was all women that had come to it. And we basically just, we would hear that it just, you couldn't have a female driven film because women meant very little in the foreign market, and foreign market at the time, it's similar ish depending on the film, but was for this budget film was about 60% of sales. And since women meant less in the foreign market, it was going to be harder to get the money back. So, and because, you know, 95% of venture capital in this country goes to men or male driven companies, I mean, we had a little bit of an uphill battle, you know, and it seemed like there weren't any female financiers that we'd gone out to or that we knew of. It seems like all these men were like, I don't get it. I don't resonate with the story. And I don't think this is going to see any money. And so it just kind of like fell apart.
So as a writer, mm-hmm. and an actor, and then you start writing the script, and then you start wanting to actually start making this film, getting into finding venture capital, fundraising, crowdsourcing. How much experience did you have about this world that you were kind of stepping into?
Back then, none. I had none, and I wasn't doing any of that. That was more our foreign sales agent, NEP, who was going that direction with it. I was on, you know, I was taking notes and reworking the script and sitting in all the meetings. And I just learned a ton because, again, this wasn't my background. I came from the acting world. But so this time, and actually it was my EP that said, who wasn't on it this time because she works at a higher budget level, but she said, Rainey, just make it. And she said this to me years ago in a time where I didn't I didn't know, like, just make it. I mean, literally, I mean, I think I went to my computer, like, how to make a movie. Like, it was like I had to start somewhere. So it got shelved, and then, you know, I had this sort of fearless moment in my life, and I decided to take the project back and heed her words and just make it. So I was like, okay, I'll do a crowdfunding campaign. That sounds easy. The Midwest will fund my film $1 at a time. And it just was, yeah, it was successful, but it was not, that's not the case, you know. The bulk of crowdfunding comes from your circle and once removed. So it was a long process. But that gave us our first seed money, and it legitimized us because there was this campaign video with me where it said, Rainey Kerwin, writer-director, on screen, and I was talking about myself, and I was now a writer-director because it said so.
That's right.
And Indiegogo made, we were successful and we were on a legitimate platform. And so that somehow parlayed me to getting the next five investors on board who, don't ask me how I did it. Some people have asked me how, like, I don't know. I put it out on this and then somebody saw it on this and then a friend of a friend heard about an all female something. And it just, it came to be. And I'm not saying it was easy. I just kept saying, I'm going to make this film. I don't know how I'm going to make this film. And finally it got funded and we did.
Well, I guess the idea of just, as long as you keep putting something out there, you don't know who is ever going to see it. So,
right.
So that, just putting it out there, that increases the chances of something happening exponentially, yeah. As opposed to like, well, we'll just sit here and talk about something we could do.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So as you're so doing this whole experience, what is your, how has your view of the industry changed now before when you first started off? Did you have more of a, I don't want to say like rose-colored glasses about the industry, but now seeing just everything that's involved in trying to actually get a film made, has it kind of changed your perspective on it?
Yeah, I will never say anything bad about anyone's movie again. Like, just knowing how much work it is to get that on the screen, it floors me. It floors me that we're here. But it also, the amount of times, I mean, because I refer to it as a baby, and I was just trying not to kill it. And there's so many opportunities to drop the baby where it's like, done, didn't happen. You know, like, this fell apart. We're not going to get past this. We don't have the money for this. And so I'm so grateful that along the way in this, you know, during post, I was the post-production supervisor, but I was working, it would be me and the editor and then me and the colorist and me and sound and me. So I worked with all these people that were great in their field. But in terms of rose-colored glasses for the industry, I don't have them. I don't know that I did before. I don't know that I work in the industry. I mean, I'm very much on the outskirts of Hollywood. I exist in this independent film world. Like, this is a massive, wonderful, loving community where you say you're a first-time director and it's a badge of honor, versus I feel like the traditional Hollywood that's frowned upon, you know? So I feel that this community is just, I've just been immersed in it, and I do favors, people do me favors, and it's a great space to be in. But I haven't really worked in the Hollywood industry, and I don't really know what that's like. I remember years ago Quentin Tarantino said, he said, I was so not in the industry that the joke was, if you wanted to write a letter to me, just address it to me and write on the outskirts of Hollywood and it would get to me. And I feel like, well, he's not there now. I mean, he's on the inskirts, but that's where I feel like I am. I'm just sort of independently doing what I like. And I guess with no studio over me, I didn't have to take out the mustache scene, which
that's right.
I'm sure would not have flown with any studio.
Oh, come on, that's a great scene. But doing all this, do you realize that now there are so many different platforms to showcase a project?
Yeah.
That maybe the Hollywood system, as you know, growing up, that we kind of learned about and read about, doesn't quite exist in the same way anymore. That there, you don't have to really rely on, like, I've got to get into the fast track of the Hollywood system to be successful, to have a career, to be able to show my work to people who would like to watch it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's so many people that do work successfully on the outskirts of Hollywood. I mean, like, I'm such a fan of the Duplass brothers. Aside from being a fan of their work, I'm just a fan of who they are and how they exist. And I know they, you know, they're in the Hollywood world, but they're also, you know, they EP a lot of stuff on the outskirts and continue to move that kind of art forward. So, and in terms of platforms, I mean, you know, I have a friend who's a film called Odd Brodsky, and she released it, she distributed it on her own. So she's windowing. So the first window was iTunes, and the next window is Amazon. And so there is a place for this stuff now, this content. It's just a matter of how you get eyes on it and how you rise above. And because we do have a lot as independent filmmakers. We have the opportunity to put these scenes in the film and cast who we want and work in that world. But what we don't have and what we lack, and equipment is cheap and cameras are cheap. Like, you can make good quality stuff, but we don't have the money for marketing, and that's where we get separated. That's where we work so hard to get, you know, the festival circuit. I was on it for a year and it was great, but I mean, you work your butt off on that circuit, and that's where we fall short, not being able to get eyes on it or relying on some great, maybe it's the show today, maybe we will explode right. on this show today.
That's right. I'm a tastemaker, everybody. You heard it here first. So, you mentioned casting. Now, yeah. What was it like? Certainly, you've been an actor going into auditions. Mm-hmm. Now you're running the cast room. You're in there. You're scheduling these appointments for everybody to come into audition. What did
it's so unglamorous. Yeah. Yes. I literally am calling like I'm a PA on the... Yeah.
What was it like being on the other side of the camera? How did you want... It's like, you know what? These casting rooms that I've been into as an actor, I want to make sure I don't do this for the actors that are coming in for my project.
I wanted it to be a warm setting. I remember the very last audition I went on. It wasn't That 70s Show because it was a commercial audition. And I went and it was a great... I don't know what it was for. It was cellular or something. And I got there and there was nobody in line, which is really weird. And there were sides, you know, and I thought... This is great. Something to sink my... Because I'm a comedic actor. You know, I'm not the model that... I never booked those, you know. But anyway, so they said, oh, we're ready for you. Come on in. I was like, oh, great. I'm just going to read the board and the side. And they're like, we're ready. It's on the board in there. And I read it cold. And they were like, thank you. And that was... Like, I didn't even do anything with it, you know? It was like, that was... I was like... And the dog went... And they're like, we got it. I was like, can I do it? No, we got it. And that... I was like, I drove across town and shaved my legs for that, you know? And so... I drove straight from there to my commercial agents and quit.
Really?
I've never been on an audition since then. Yeah, so I wanted to... Because I think casting directors go about this two different ways. Some want you to suck, and not that they want everybody to suck, but they just want to weed it out to get down to one, right? They need the person to be great, too, but it's like a clear-cut decision is always great. So either be amazing or be terrible. And I didn't want that. I wanted everybody to kind of have this opportunity to feel safe in the room. So I think I suck as a casting director in that I'm like pitching the project in the room, like, what's going to be fun on set? And but it's like a family. I mean, I said to like Camille and Owen, who came in for it, I remember because Camille sat on the lip of the stage. She came in wearing stilettos because she locked her keys in her car and couldn't get like her flip-flops that she wanted to audition in. So she was in stilettos and she's like, I'm so sorry, I'm in stilettos. And so after her, she took them off and then she's sitting on the lip of the stage, and I said, you know, this is a passion project, like we're all on board to make this great, so you're gonna definitely change in the back seat of my Prius at some point, and you're definitely gonna hold a flag and lift a C-stand, and like that's how we're making this film. So it was kind of like the pitch of like, this is fun, before people would even audition. I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's how I hired everyone, too. It was, you know, they weren't really interviews as much as it was me saying, hey, what am I kicking? Sorry, I'm going to unplug something. It was me saying, like, this is going to be fun. Do you want to do it? And I feel like, you know, what is this all about? You know, this is what we want to do. We want to make movies. Well, it should be fun. And I thought I was going to see real, true people if I gave them an environment to be safe in. So that was always my goal with everything.
Did you notice a difference in terms of the performances by creating a casting room that gives those actors that kind of chance to feel safe and try something?
Well, who knows? Because I don't know them. I mean, they could have been terrible elsewhere, but just brilliant.
Right there.
I hope so. But I don't really know. But aside from that, I hope that people felt like they got their best performance out. That was really my goal, just creating that environment where people aren't worried, because a lot of people's intention sometimes is not to get you to pass the salt, but it's to get to the end of the monologue. And so my intention in this room was for them to get what they wanted in the scene, not get to the end of it. So yeah, so I hope that people got the salt.
So for you, now being on the casting side of it, when it comes down to, you said the casting directors want somebody to be great or somebody to be just terrible.
Yeah.
But was, so when it comes down to making the decision, was it easy for you?